Welcome to Ominous Ones. I'm Tara.
I'm not Tara.
We're a true crime podcast that covers missing people, murders, and all things ominous.
Are we?
If you like what you hear, make sure to like and subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. And yes, we are.
Pound that like button. Smash it. What did they say in the videos?
I don't know. I don't watch the videos.
Smash that like button.
And subscribe button.
Destroy it so that you can't unlike us ever again.
Perfect. You ready for my story?
I am.
On December 7th, 1971, a neighbor went to check on the List family, which consisted of John, Helen, their three kids, and John's mom. Neighbors had noticed that the family's lights were on in their mansion day and night, and they never went off. Eventually, they saw the lights burning out one by one, so they called the cops to do a welfare check. Also, I'm like, how quickly does a light bulb just burn out?
Is it a light bulb or is it a candle?
It's a light bulb in the 70s. While people said the family kept to themselves, they found no one had actually seen the family in about a month. Notes had been sent to the kids' schools saying the kids were going to be visiting their grandma who was sick, and deliveries to the house had been canceled, like their newspaper and the milk delivery. The cops who showed up did not expect to find what they did. Inside the house, they found Helen and the couple's three kids dead in the ballroom in sleeping bags. John's mother, Alma, was found dead in her apartment in the attic.
I feel like I've heard this story before.
After searching the house, they found a letter John had written to his pastor. It was 5 pages long. He wrote he had seen too much evil and he had killed them all to save their souls, and that they would all, quote, turn from God, unquote. So if he killed them all, they could get into heaven.
Oh, wow. He's so generous. Tell me, does this bruise look like a ghost to you?
Or I really love that you're paying attention to my story.
I am.
I can tell. That looks like an alien. Have you heard the story before?
I think so. But continue, because I think I know how he killed them. But until I find that information out from what you're telling me, it could be a different story. You guys killed their families all the time.
Sure. So back to John. He had cleaned the whole house, turned the radio onto a religious channel, and then methodically cut himself out of every single family picture.
Did his grandma, or his mom, the kid's grandma, lived upstairs?
Yeah.
Oh, I think I might have heard this one. Keep going.
So, cutting himself out of the pictures would help him on the run because no one was positive what he looked like beyond descriptions. He then spent the night in the house with the bodies and left the next morning.
They were supposed to go on vacation or something?
No. It was just a normal day. For the backstory, John List was born...
Some of the kids were at school.
Yeah.
And another kid came to the door.
No.
During the time that it was happening, while he was killing them, he was trying to sell something or mow the lawn or something like that.
No.
I swear to God.
I don't know what you're talking about. So, for the backstory, John List was born September 17th, 1925, in Bay City, Michigan. He was an only child. The same year he graduated high school, in 1943, he enlisted in the Army and served during World War II as a lab tech. He was discharged in 1946, and then he enrolled at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, where he got his bachelor's in business administration and a master's in accounting, and he also joined the ROTC. In 1950, the Army wanted John back, so he was recalled to active duty. He met his wife when he was sent to Fort Eustis, I think is how you say that, in Virginia. Her name was Helen, and she was living there after she was widowed from her husband, who was killed in action, and Helen already had a daughter named Brenda. John married Helen on December 1st, 1951, in Baltimore, and then the family moved to California. At some point in all of that, the Army reassigned him to a finance section, since he now had that accounting degree. His second tour was over in 1952, but John continued to work in accounting and got a job in Detroit before becoming an audit supervisor in Kalamazoo, Michigan. John and Helen went
on... That sounds impressive.
What?
Being an audit, whatever the fuck
supervisor? That sounds really boring.
Well, that sounds like you would make a lot of money doing it, though.
Yeah, but it'd be really boring. John and Helen had three kids while they were in Kalamazoo. In 1959, John was doing well in his job and was now the general supervisor, but his marriage wasn't doing well. Helen was allegedly an alcoholic and suffering from syphilis, which she had gotten from her first husband, but she had possibly not told John that she had it.
Oh, that's wild.
I saw it reported that she told him and he acted like she didn't, or she didn't, and it was a surprise. But.
So, syphilis, I know now they have a cure for it. They didn't back then, huh?
I think they could like handle it if she was admitting it, but she didn't tell anyone, so it wasn't being treated at all. But I think there
You
was.
go crazy from that.
Yeah, John said syphilis was making Helen act unstable. But yeah, I've heard stories it makes people lose it. In 1960, the family moved again, this time to Rochester, New York, after John got a job at Xerox. Brenda, Helen's daughter from her first marriage, didn't move with the family this time. She was already married and living with her husband.
I have
John
a
was.
friend that got syphilis from her cheating boyfriend.
Is that still around? Like, I know stuff like that doesn't just disappear, but I couldn't tell you the last time I heard of someone having it.
Today, right now, you just did.
Right now. It's treatable now,
Yeah.
though? That's wild. John was doing good at Xerox, but for some reason he left in 1965 and ended up taking a job as vice president of a bank in Jersey City, moving his family and mom, Elma, into a 19-room mansion called Breeze Knoll
Knew it.
that included marble fireplaces, a Tiffany skylight, and the ballroom.
He
Walt,
shoots his mom, huh?
yeah.
And she's in a wheelchair.
I don't know. I don't think she was in a wheelchair, but yeah, he shoots her. I really like that you're.
She's the first one to die, huh?
No, his wife was. While there, the family was big into the Lutheran church, and John taught Sunday school there. And then we know what happened 6 years later. So back to John on the run. A nationwide search was started, and leads were followed, but it was hard since no one had pictures of him. John's car, a 1963 Impala, was found in New York at the JFK airport. But there were no tickets for him getting on a flight, so they thought that he might have left it there to throw him off. Alma's body was taken to Frankenmuth, Michigan, to be buried, and then Helen and the three kids were buried in Westfield, where they share a headstone. 9 months after the bodies were found, someone burned down the mansion, and they never solved who did it. And they make a really big deal that the fire ruined the Tiffany stained glass skylight that I mentioned before. It was worth about $700,000 now and $100,000 back then.
Jesus.
Someone's like, oh no, the mansion burned down and all those people died. They're like, but what about the Tiffany skylight?
That's wild.
They looked for John for 18 years with no luck. And then America's Most Wanted ran the story on the show in May of 1989. This was what?
Bleeding to death. You
Okay.
don't even care.
I'm reading you a story and you don't even care.
I do care. I've been listening to all of it and I'm predicting 90% of it.
Wrongly.
I said 90%, 10% I've had it incorrectly.
So America's Most Wanted ran the story on the show in May of 1989. This was the first year the show was on. On the show, Frank Bender's clay age progression bust of John was shown to 22 million viewers. A lot of tips came in, but one from a guy in Denver, Colorado, who thought the bust looked a lot like his old neighbor Robert Clark, who had since moved to Virginia, worked out. The caller said Robert was an accountant and regularly attended church, which they knew John did. 10 days later, on June 1st, 1989, Robert was arrested at his accounting firm in Virginia. For a few months, Robert insisted he was Robert. That same year, he was extradited to New Jersey, where his fingerprints were matched to John List, and he finally admitted to being John on February 16th in 1990.
Jesus.
They found that John, in 1971, had ditched the car at JFK. Taken a train from New Jersey to Michigan to Colorado, where he stayed in Denver.
They didn't check the train logs.
Well, I don't know what name he was going under, but I feel like they checked everywhere they could. He got an accounting job and started going under the name Robert Peter Clark, and he went by Bob. John said the real Robert Clark was an old college classmate of his. John said they were friends, or at least knew each other, but real Robert Clark said he had no idea who John really was. He's
That's
like,
settling.
yeah, never heard of the guy. Don't
It's
know
like,
if
I
I've
have
seen
no
somebody.
idea who that is. But how many people from high school could steal your name? And you would be like, I have no idea who that is.
I don't know people's names anyway. Like,
Same.
ever. Even like at work or anything, I'm like, wait, what's their name? So yeah, I feel like that. I'd be like, I don't know who that is.
Somebody could introduce themselves to me right now at my front door, and within 5 minutes of them leaving, the police could show up and be like, have you ever met Caitlyn Jenner? For, I don't know, just a name that came to my mind. And I'd be like, I have no fucking idea who you're talking about.
Yep.
Never met that person before in my life. And the police would be like, I literally just watched her walk from your front door. I'd be like, oh, is that her name?
Yeah, your memory's trash.
So.
In Denver, John slash Fake Bob joined a Lutheran church and helped in the church's carpool. At a church gathering, John met Dolores Miller, who he married in 1985. In 1988, they moved to Virginia, where John again got an accounting job and was still going as Bob Clark, and then he was arrested the next year.
This story is very similar to the one that I have seen before on a documentary. And it's ironic that the mom was living upstairs too and that he used a firearm also. I mean, I guess they mostly use firearms. They're gonna kill a whole family, but his mom also lived there.
That does sound kind of familiar with the wheelchair.
Yeah. And he went in and talked to her and was like spilled his little heart out before he killed her, and she was the first one to die.
Yikes.
So it's very similar. Strange.
What else is strange is that Dolores is never mentioned again. So John's going as Bob, marries her in 1985, 1988, they're in Virginia. John's like going to work and then gets arrested, and then all this comes out, and then you never hear another word about Dolores. But I'm like, imagine the surprise to her.
She was like, do not involve me in your bullshit. I am a God-fearing woman.
And he's ruined my life. I had no idea who, I didn't even know his name.
Facts.
So with John arrested, the story behind the murders came out. John said he had taken his 9mm and his dad's 22 revolver and shot Helen in the back of the head when she was drinking her morning coffee. She was 47. He then went upstairs and shot his 85-year-old mom, Alma, above her left eye while she was still in bed. His daughter, 16-year-old Patricia, and 13-year-old son, Frederick, got home from school, and John shot them both in the back of the head.
This has to be the same story. And I could just be like confusing it because it's so
Because
similar.
your memory's trash.
Yes.
John then made himself a sandwich and drove to the bank to close his account and his
His friend's
mom's.
kids came over first and wanted to shovel the driveway or something.
You're mixing stories up.
I'm not.
So John kills them, made himself a sandwich, went to the bank, got all the cash out, got all his mom's cash out. Then he went to his son's 15-year-old John Frederick school and watched him play a soccer game, took him home, and shot him a few times because the gun misfired and 15-year-old John had tried to fight back. The bodies
And that's when the shovelers came.
were then put into sleeping bags, and John cleaned up and spent the night and then left. He went to trial and testified that in 1971 he was laid off when the bank he worked at closed. He didn't want to tell his family that he lost his job, so he continued to live his life like he still worked at the bank. He was like, oh, everything's fine.
Where is he going for the day for that many hours?
He dressed the same and left the house in the morning at the same time and came home at the right time. In reality, he would leave the house in the morning and go to job interviews or just hang out at the local train station. To pay the bills, John was stealing money from his mom, but that was eventually going to run out, and John was getting worried. He told his kids they should get jobs to learn responsibility, but he really just needed any money that anyone could make. So he's like, oh, I'm teaching you responsibility, but I'm also going to be needing all of the money that you make.
Jesus.
Helen's mom was supposed to be at the house, but she had canceled when she got sick, and John later admitted she was going to be his sixth victim. Which I'm like, I don't know why. He said he was also stressed in his marriage to Helen. She was drinking all the time and had lied to him. When they had first gotten together, she told him she was pregnant and they had to get married, but that turned out to not be true. She had then insisted they get married in Maryland, which he later figured out was because the state didn't require syphilis tests like other states did. And he said she had kept it from him for 18 years, that she was positive for it. She kept it from him.
I can't imagine going to marry somebody and they're like, hey, you have to take a test for syphilis before you guys get married.
Yeah, that was a thing all the states had. Well, most of them.
I'd be like, well, we've had sex already. Does it matter?
Yeah, but
she said that she was pregnant, so they had already had sex. So let's say she tests positive. Okay, well, we've already done it.
Well, I feel like back then you weren't supposed to have already done it. So,
but they had.
But I feel like you weren't supposed to. So
in the 70s?
So I feel like the states were like, it was the 60s, but I feel like the states were like, yeah, don't do that before marriage. Don't be smooching. She kept it from him and everyone until 1969 when a doctor found out she had it and then everybody knew. John said with the syphilis going untreated for that long and with her drinking, it had, quote, transformed her into an unkempt and paranoid recluse, unquote. He also said that
maybe we have syphilis. We're very reclusive.
We don't. I can guarantee you that. Well, you might, but I don't.
I do not.
You might.
I get tested for everything.
You should. It's a good thing. <Are you? laughs> No thanks. Have you been tested lately?
Yeah, when I was pregnant with the baby.
No, I need a more recent one.
Thanks, anybody.
John also said she liked to publicly humiliate him and would compare him to her first husband, which usually upset him, like rightfully so.
Yeah, absolutely.
A psychiatrist was brought in on the case and found John had obsessive-compulsive personality disorder. In his head, he only had two options, kill the family and save their souls, and mostly not have anyone find out he couldn't support them, or he could get welfare. John's dad was big on taking care of your own family and supporting them, and it was ingrained in John that he had to take care of them or kill them, which to him was also taking care of them. He was like, well, if I can't take care of you, I'll kill you, and then you won't know that I can't take care of you, and that's
because you'll be taken care of.
And there you go.
Because you'll be dead. You won't need any more taking care ofness.
John was convicted of 5 counts of first-degree murder on April 12, 1990. When he was being sentenced, he said it wasn't totally his fault. He said, quote, he felt that because of my mental state at the time, I was unaccountable for what happened. I asked all affected by this for their forgiveness, understanding, and prayer, unquote. He was given 5 life sentences. The judge said, quote, John Emil List is without remorse and without honor. After 18 years, 5 months, and 22 days, it is now time for the voices of Helen, Alma, Patricia, Frederick, and John F. List to rise from the grave, unquote.
They're gonna rise, and now they're all gonna be living, and he's gonna be in prison.
He said their voices, and they don't come back as zombies at the end of this.
That's unfortunate.
John appealed his sentence, saying he had PTSD from the army, and that his 5-page letter he had left to the pastor at the house was supposed to be confidential and not brought into the trial. His appeals were all rejected.
Why didn't they come back as spirits then? If not zombies.
They don't come back. In 2002, he told Connie Chung, quote, I wish I had never done what I did. I've regretted my action and prayed for forgiveness ever since, unquote. When John was asked why he didn't kill himself, he said suicide meant he wouldn't get into heaven where he wanted to go to be with his family. John died March 21st, 2008 at St. Francis Medical Center in Trenton, New Jersey of pneumonia. He was sometimes called the, quote, boogeyman of Westfield. On a side note, in 1972, they thought John might have been D.B. Cooper. John went missing 2 weeks before the D.B. Cooper incident, but the FBI now thinks it wasn't him, but it is involved in some of the conspiracies.
That's wild.
And that was the story of the List family. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you guys later.
Bye.